was Lost in the Stars with Jane Ira Bloom on soprano saxophone, Charlie Hayden on bass, Ed Blackwell on drums, and Fred Hirsch at the piano from Jane Ira Bloom's most recent album, Mighty Lights, on the Enger record label. And again, she will be performing this Saturday night at the Painted Bride Arts Center with sets at 8:30 and 10. We'll be broadcasting the 10 o'clock set live. If you'd like to call the Bride for ticket information, if you want to see it in person, their number's 925-9914. And Jane, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you.
Let's talk about how you started to play. Were you playing saxophone as early as grade school?
Yeah, if you can believe it, as early as third grade in public school system in Newton, Massachusetts.
How did you end up with saxophone, since clarinets, flutes are for women, saxophones are usually singled out for the men when they're assigning instruments?
Well, it's not really a very dramatic story. At the age of 9 or 10, I wanted to play a shiny instrument, and I got a list from the school. And my first choice really was trumpet. But my parents didn't want me to play trumpet, so I picked the next shiniest instrument, and that was saxophone. And that's what I sort of stayed with for a while.
Were you encouraged to continue with it?
Yeah, my parents were very supportive of my interest in music. I had I'd shown a real strong interest in music when I was very young, piano at age 4, you know, and interest in all kinds of musical instruments in it. I think all throughout my early years, they were helping me with lessons and driving me to bands, concert band rehearsals and stage bands.
Were you ever discouraged from playing saxophone and encouraged to take up a quote, more feminine instrument?
I can't recall that. I can only recall once being music director tried to convince me to study bassoon because he needed it in the band and they didn't need any more saxophones. But that's all I can remember.
Did you play in any bands when you were in junior high and high school?
Sure.
Bands outside of school, I'm thinking of now.
On a you know, purely, you know, loose level, played with the students who were in the school at the time. We had bands that went on outside of class.
Were you interested in jazz at that age?
Yeah, I really was.
Who were you listening to?
Who was I listening to? I didn't know an awful lot about jazz at the time, but I think my earliest influences were a collection of Ella Fitzgerald records that my mother had in the house. I think my earliest music teachers told me, you know, to get some Charlie Parker records. I got a Paul Desmond record, Sonny Rollins records. Everything was new at that time. I was just listening to anything I'd get my hands on.
How did you start to make yourself known when you started to mature on the instrument? What were the first things that you did?
I made a record very early on in what you'd call a career. Very shortly after it was actually at the time that I was graduating from music school. I made a record, a document of a musical collaboration I had with a bassist that I worked with for many years at Yale. And I decided that the only way I could document this music was if I made my own record. And so I went about the process of learning how to make records and how to have a record company and how to design an album cover and all kinds of things and see if I could produce it myself.
It's still very unusual, I think, for there to be women instrumentalists. Women have still been more accepted as vocalists within jazz. And jazz remains a very male music, not only in terms of the performers, but a lot of the jazz listeners tend to be men, too, for some curious reason. Do you think it's been any harder for you to break in as a woman than it would have been as a man? Or maybe it's been the other way. Maybe you've gotten more attention.
Well, it goes both ways. I got a lot of interesting attention at a very early time in my career. I appeared at a women's jazz festival in Kansas City just after getting out of school. And it was the first kind of major recognition I'd ever gotten as a player or an artist before. And at that time, women's jazz festivals were a bit in vogue. There were quite a few of them going on. It was new, and a lot of media attention was going toward this. But I found, as the years were going by, that this was becoming less and less of a new thing and less of an important thing to me. And I could see sort of slowing down trends in my opportunities as an artist. And up to this point, I would say I've been plodding along just about like any other male musician who is about my age and ability. And I think we're about the same points. I don't know if that might change.
Were the women's festivals helpful to you?
At the beginning of my career, they were. And then I made a conscious choice to stay away from that direction.
How come?
Well, I felt that I didn't want to be associated with a standard, a woman jazz musician. I wanted to be known for the fact that I was a very, you know, a very fine, you know, player, musician who was a woman and very proud of being feminine and being a woman. But I didn't like the sense of there being some other standard to my musicality because of my sex. And I think that's a very different statement than saying that, as I look at it now, that I have very conscious knowledge of there being very important things about my femininity or, you know, my womanhood relating to my music now. But I see those as two different areas.
I know some women have consciously left the male jazz scene to form a kind of women's network. Do you think that could be detrimental in that you're not playing with the people who already have the reputation and the mastery?
Well, you'd be surprised how many music groups and organizations get combined and put together on the basis of social ease. You know, what people who you're comfortable working with. And if you're comfortable working with women, then that's the most important place for you to be, and you should be there. And there are some rigors to working with men you don't know and who don't know you. There's a lot of stress there.
Like what?
Of men simply not being used to working with women. I think it's like women in any new field. And you have to deal with those pressures and deal with a lot more understanding than you could possibly imagine. And yet, if you, like I said, to get back to your original question, I think you are probably doing yourself a little bit of a disservice if you're closing off some opportunities of playing with some other people because they are men, because they're fine musicians, and you should play with them too.
When you can tell that a male musician is uncomfortable around you because they haven't played with woman instrumentalists before, what will you do to either prove yourself or make them more comfortable?
Well, a lot of it gets resolved in the music making. Once you play, there's a big difference between when you walked in the room and after you've played some music together, because music has a way of among musicians, of binding them and having a very important nonverbal kind of understanding of one another. So a lot of that goes on, and a lot of that is not even talked about. What do I do? Gee, I don't know. I understand that there are pressures about accepting women in leadership positions in music, and I'm not even aware of the things I do. Probably be good to ask somebody who I work with. They'd probably know better than I do.
Have you run into situations where men felt uncomfortable with you as the leader of the group?
I'm sure that's existed. No one's actually confronted me verbally, you know, directly about that problem. I'm sure it's existed at times. And a lot of times I might have had blinders onto it in order to do what you have to do. Sometimes you can't be as open-minded and conscious of all these very subtle social things that are going on. And I admit I probably have tunnel vision when it comes to certain things about music.
Are there any generational differences? Because I think a lot of women feel sometimes that men who grew up before the rebirth of the women's movement had maybe a harder time digesting what it was about and changing.
Yeah, that might be. I've found contradictions to that, and I've found examples of that. I wish I could make a hard, fast rule about it. I find the same thing with women working with other women as well. There are many generations now of women who have worked and have different attitudes about the music and how they've had to struggle through it and different experiences. I find, for example, Ed Blackwell, who's certainly of an older generation of musicians, one of the most generous and understanding musicians I've ever worked with. And I don't seem to find problems. Yes, there's newness about our work together, but I think I have the feeling that it depends a lot on the human being that you're standing next to. Who are they?
Jane Ira Bloom is my guest if you're just joining us. Do you feel part of a generation of musicians? Because you're in your late 20s now, and there is a generation who's starting to come of age, whose work is featured prominently in the jazz press, who are composing as well as playing. Do you think that there are any things that hold this generation together, any generalizations that you can make about their playing or composing?
Yeah, I would say, if I can think off the top of my head, of a few generalizations about current trends that seem to be in the writing and playing of players in these last couple of decades, is that I think jazz forms and structures have been twisted around a lot. My generation of musicians, I think, has not taken quite as many of the parameters of jazz playing as golden rules anymore. Different kinds of meters and times are being played around with, different kinds of songs. Compositional structures are being used and borrowed from world musics, from classical musics, much like probably more in the line of what Duke Ellington was starting.
You're an example of someone who has a master's from Yale, which is no longer uncommon.
Yeah, that's true. A large generation of these musicians have been coming out of colleges, and there's a reason for that. There aren't, at the time that we were growing up playing, there weren't places for us to go out to clubs and learn by experience, by jamming, as they talked about in the old days. That just didn't exist. We learned through records and whatever playing experience we could gather, which is usually, you know, self-initiated or through some kind of school system, maybe, or putting together whatever you could on your own, I think. I think that's a big difference.
No, that reminds me of a situation which I could see being a woman being a possible disadvantage, and that is if there were clubs, if there were more clubs, and you wanted to hang out at clubs alone and listen to music, as a lot of men traditionally have when they were coming of age in jazz, it would be a lot harder to do as a woman, since a woman alone in a club or a bar is always perceived as someone who wants to be picked up, and it's hard to just
That's very true.
Be there to listen to something when you're alone.
Yeah, that's true to this day. Matter of fact, there's almost like unspoken rule that if you are going to a club that isn't entirely focused on the music, it has, you know, other, you know, social aspects to it, sit near the bandstand, know one of the musicians, you know, stay close to the music, and perhaps you won't get bothered. Because that is still a tension, yeah. It is there.
Do people bother you on the bandstand?
No, I can't say that happens that often, no.
I want to play another selection from your latest record, Mighty Lights, and we're going to hear one of your own pieces, 251. Can you talk about this piece before we hear it?
Sure. It's a piece that was originally in a 15-piece ensemble version, which I later narrowed down to a quintet and then to a quartet here with sax, piano, bass, and drums. And 251 is kind of a title which hides the chord progression that's at the basis of this music. Not that it would mean anything to a general audience, but it describes a kind of progression that is hidden in this piece.
Okay, well, let's hear 251 with Jane Ira Bloom on soprano, Ed Blackwell on drums, Charlie Hayden bass, Fred Hirsch at the piano, also from the album Mighty Lights on the Ender record label.
Thank you.
251 from Jane Ira Bloom's album Mighty Lights on the Enter record label, with Charlie Hayden on bass, Fred Hirsch at the piano, and Eddie Blackwell on drums. And that's on the Enter record label. Jane Ira Bloom will be performing this Saturday in Philadelphia at the Painted Bride Art Center with sets at 8:30 and 10 o'clock. We'll be broadcasting the 10 o'clock set, and for more information, you can call 925-9914. Jane Ira Bloom lives in New York and is visiting us today. Soprano saxophone usually is the second instrument of alto or tenor saxophonists. How did it become your first?
Well, it always went alongside the alto saxophone with me. You learn to play saxophone usually on an alto or tenor, but I learned on alto. And at a very early time in my education, I had a teacher who had a kind of very special feeling for the soprano. His name was Joe Viola. He taught in Boston. And I got a hold of a soprano very early on when I was studying. And as a result of learning it while studying, I spent a lot of time with the instrument. So, as you say, it wasn't a double. It was very much an instrument that I spent a lot of time studying and working on and figuring out. And as you know, in most cases in jazz playing, the soprano was picked up as a secondary instrument for the tenor player, who's also playing a B-flat instrument, or for an alto player, whatever.
What are some of the quirks of the instrument?
Well, it's hard to play. It's hard to keep in tune. Intonation is a problem that most people know about. It's hard to play. It's an instrument that almost resists doing certain kinds of things on it. You almost have to finesse the instrument in it doing certain kinds of things. And that's what I mean by it's difficult to play. To make it sing, to make it flow, you know, musically, melodically. It's a quick instrument as well, and when you're playing in a time context, like with a rhythm section, it requires a real sensitive typewriter to your fingers. In other words, the slightest touch moves you pretty fast, and that makes it slightly different from the other saxophones. And it has its own specific problems that are different from the other alto or tenor saxophones. It's higher. It seems to move faster. It's, like I say, harder to keep in tune. And it also enjoys the status of not having an awful lot of lineage of jazz history, so that as a soprano saxophone player, you have a little more of an open field to try some newer things that haven't been done on the instrument.
I think the instrument became much more popular after Coltrane started playing it. Has he been one of your influences, or have your influences been other soprano players?
Well, my influences on soprano haven't originated very strongly from other soprano players. Of course, I've listened a great deal to Coltrane and to Steve Lacy and a bit to Sidney Bechet, not quite as much to early music. But my influences for the soprano come from different areas than saxophonists. I think they come a little more from trumpet playing, which finds itself in a very similar register to the soprano, and melodically from vocalists, and maybe in a creative way more from contemporary new music. Now, I don't know how you put that all together, but it makes something a little different.
You were telling me before that when you were first getting started that you were offered a position in the Mercer Ellington Band, which was touring, and you turned it down. Why didn't you want to do that?
Oh, it was a tough decision. It was right after I'd gotten out of school. And I went down one night with the Mercer Ellington Orchestra down to New Jersey to play a concert, and had the full experience of sitting on the band bus and going, driving down and playing the concert and coming back. And my decision was it had a lot of parts to it, one of them being that it was very easy to see that that's a very, very difficult life. And I wasn't even prepared for it, living on the band bus, one-night stands. Emotionally, I wasn't ready for that. Second part was that I had an idea, even at early time, that I wanted to be strong. I had a strong idea of what I thought my own music was and my own ideas were. And I think that's a little unusual, but I really did have a pretty strong sense of that. And I wanted to follow the other direction. It's traditional for most young saxophonists to join a big band and start their career. And I had some experiences already while still in school, playing as a professional, that led me to believe that I could have a chance following my own route instead of going through the big band system. And so it was a scary choice, but I guess I made it at the time, not knowing what I was in for, really.
What are the options open to you now? One of the advantages of a band like that is when you're on the road, you get a salary, and you don't have to worry about hustling up enough club engagements to make a living. Especially when you're recording on small labels, it's rare, I think, for a record to sell enough to really sustain you financially. What kind of options are open on the New York scene now for you or for jazz musicians like you?
It's a tough life. It's really slim. It took me 5 or 6 years to be invited to play at one of the major new jazz night spots in New York, the Village Vanguard, the Sweet Basils, I mean, that kind of thing. Took a long time. The possibility of having a future working there regularly at such meager sums is not, you know, it's not a great looking future. You don't get paid very much. It's a lot of hard work, and the clubs are dying. They're not, you know, flourishing and doing as well as you might think they are, and there are very few opportunities. There's so many musicians that you can't count on regular work unless you're in a particularly, you know, very well-established bracket of musicians. You know, the younger new artists really do have to struggle to get opportunities to play. Most people don't even understand that. It's much more like trying to play new music, new jazz at this point in time is a lot closer to trying to be a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Than trying to be anything else in this society. And if that makes any more sense to people's understanding of what it's like, no financial rewards, forget it. I mean, you just somehow you just keep going. You just keep doing what you love to do.
We've heard selections from your most recent record, and in a moment we're going to hear one from an earlier record on your own record label. Do you have plans for a future record?
There are things in the air right now. I'm crossing my fingers. I can't talk about them yet,
right?
Because I'm not sure if they're going to come through or not, but the next one is in the making.
Can you give us a preview of what's to come Saturday night at your concert at the Bride?
I'll be joined by Ed Blackwell on drums, Fred Hirsch on piano, Mark Helias on bass, and we'll perform quite a few original compositions of mine. I'm probably going to even throw in a few older compositions of mine from my very first album, which haven't been heard quite a bit, and as well as some new things that I've written, and some Ornette Coleman tunes, which I always enjoy playing.
Great.
Especially with Ed.
One last question. How did you get the middle name Ira Jane?
That was my grandfather's name, who died just before I was born. So that, in Jewish family, that's traditional that you next born gets that name.
It's still unusual to give a male name to a female.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed it, and I enjoy your music.
And, thank you very much for having me. It's been real easy to talk.
We're going to hear a selection from your album, Second Wind, which is on your own Outline record label, and we're going to hear an excerpt of 10 Years After the Rainbow. Would you say a little bit about this?
It was a composition. It's a standard. It's an arrangement of a very well-known standard, Over the Rainbow. Very often when I play standard compositions, I like to integrate them into some composition of my own, and that's what you're going to hear here.
Okay, and this is Jane Ira Bloom from her album Second Wind.
No.